You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Joy Cardine. It's coming up on 10 minutes past 7 o'clock on this Wednesday, January the 10th. And we'll talk about the media you consume this hour and whether it concerns you, big media conglomerates own so much of the media around the country, and that some of the radio stations you listen to carry nationally syndicated programming only. And that your local TV station might be filling time with national features with no local connection. Or that the local newspaper really has fewer local stories and more syndicated material. Are you concerned about a lack of local news coverage and community service from your media? Our guest is, he says it's dangerous. It's dangerous to have so much media consolidation and big media owning so many of the once locally owned newspapers, radio, and TV stations. We'll wonder if you feel well served by the media in your town. 1-800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234. In Madison, 263-1890. 263-1890. Our guest is the author of the brand new book, Fighting for Air: The Battle to Control America's Media. Eric Kleinberg is also an associate professor of sociology at New York University. His first book, Heatwave, A Social Autopsy of Disaster in Chicago, was profiled in The New Yorker and various other national media. He has written for The Rolling Stone, The Nation, and Slate. His current book is Fighting for Air: The Battle to Control America's Media. And he joins us by telephone. Good morning.
Good morning, Joy. Nice to be here.
It's great to have you here. And you will also be at the National Conference for Media Reform this weekend. This is where you're going to officially launch the book, right?
Exactly.
Yeah, and the impetus of the book came from the first National Conference on Media Reform that happened right here in Madison, Wisconsin.
It was certainly a very big turning point for me. I had been, since finishing Heatwave, spending a lot of time doing research inside of newsrooms, newspaper companies, chain newspaper companies, radio stations, television networks. I read a lot about media consolidation, but it always seemed very abstract to me. It was hard to understand, why did it matter if ABC was owned by Disney or GE owned NBC? They're all kind of these giant companies out there. But I started to learn that media consolidation really hit home at the local level when you got inside this eerie world of canned programming in the radio world or centralized newscasts and chain newspapers. And I didn't know quite what to do with it. But then in 2003, I went to Madison for what was supposed to be this small, modest conference on media reform. They planned to have about 200 people. I was joined by about 2,000 people who literally broke the doors down on campus and turned it into this extraordinary weekend. And I realized this is the beginning of an amazing movement, a movement for media reform. It was a sign that people had just had enough. And I spent the next few years writing the book that comes out this week.
Yeah, and the one of the biggest reforms or one of the biggest fights that that conference deals with is media ownership rules. Is that still a big concern?
It is. It's a core concern of Fighting for Air. There's a line that you often hear today from the big media companies, which is that with the internet, with cable television, with cell phones, satellite radio, we don't need to worry about media ownership anymore. They say that there are more options than ever before for consumers, and in a way they're right. There is certainly more information at our disposal if we can get online and we can get information about things happening all over the world. But there's a fundamental error in that argument, which is that at the local level, we've actually seen a dramatic decline in the number of voices that have access, especially in the broadcast side.
Why is that a concern, that there are fewer local voices being heard on local radio stations?
Well, the truth is that no matter how cosmopolitan we are, no matter how globalized the world is, I think most of us live profoundly local lives. It matters to us what's happening in our local schools. It matters what the quality of our hospitals are. It matters how our local government decides to use its resources. We might have a local business that's engaging in corrupt practices. If you live in Houston, you might have been concerned about Enron in the 1990s. There are any number of issues that profoundly touch our lives and that we rely on the local media to address. I mean, let's face it, in the United States, one thing that makes us distinctive is the extraordinary power of local government. unfortunately, the internet does not make up for the loss of reporters and other personnel who've covered those parts of our lives. And so while we have lots of national voices, we don't have the cacophony at the local level that we really need to make for a vibrant democratic and cultural life.
Yeah, talk about the North Dakota town that didn't have any local media when there was a disaster.
Well, the book opens with a story that's become infamous for people who care about media consolidation. It's a story from 5 years ago this month, actually, in Minot, North Dakota, which is a town of about 37,000 people. And really, you should know it's the small and mid-sized cities of this country that have been so dramatically affected by media consolidation, I think, far more than anyone else. This is a town that had six commercial radio stations, and it used to be the case that no single company could own more than four stations in any big market, and no more than 40 stations at the national level. And in 1996, we changed the rules in a major act of deregulation and said a company could own up six or eight stations in big markets, and there was no cap on the national scene. What happened is that a company called Clear Channel Communications, which I'm sure many of you have heard of, came in and it literally acquired all six stations in Minot. And to make money on these stations in small and mid-sized markets, they basically had a standard formula. You would replace the live local DJs and talk hosts with syndicated programs and national content, the same stuff you hear wherever you go in the country. So one morning, 5 years ago, a train was traveling through town, and it was carrying toxic gas, anhydrous ammonia. The train derailed, and about 240,000 gallons of the ammonia spilled. It formed a toxic cloud that soon penetrated the homes of about 40% of the town, some 15,000 people. And anhydrous is a really dangerous chemical. It can burn the eyes and the lungs and nasal passages if you inhale it. If you inhale it, enough of it, it can kill you. Residents were suffering. They were also incredibly anxious. No one knew what was going on. Was the town being attacked? Mm-hmm. This was right after September 11th. Had there been some kind of explosion at a military base nearby? So what do you do when there's something strange going on and you're worried in this country? You turn on the radio. And we've all been drilled to know that there's emergency broadcasters who give us information, the precise kind of information that we need when something goes wrong. People throughout town started turning on their radios, went to the emergency broadcaster, and what did they get? The same kind of canned content that plays through the day.
Yeah.
Smooth jazz, big country, DJs, talking as if nothing is going on. And of course they were, because they were piping in the content, and it had been pre-recorded.
Yeah.
Nothing could have estranged the people more that night.
Let me check our local weather forecast, and then we'll return. This is the Ideas Network. I'm Joy Cardine. It's 19 minutes past 7 o'clock. We are talking with Eric Kleinenberg. He is the author of the new book, Fighting for Air, The Battle to Control America's Media. He says that one of the concerns, maybe the biggest concern over the control of our media by just a few corporations, is the demise of local journalism and local community service. 1-800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234. Do you think you are well-served with the local news you get on radio, TV, and in newspapers? In Madison, 263-1890, 263-1890. Are you as concerned as our guest is with media consolidation and media conglomerates? 1-800-642-1234 in Madison, 263-1890. Well, we just heard the story about Minot, North Dakota, having a disaster, and then no one at the radio station to locally tell people about the disaster. You're saying that this is actually dangerous to have this kind of situation.
Well, let's remember that the radio is great for our cultural lives and for news. We depend on it in this country, but during a disaster, radio immediately becomes part of the national security system. We depend on the radio to provide us emergency information, and broadcasters have an obligation to make the radio capable of doing that. Let's remember, after all, that radio depends on the use of the public airwaves. That's what makes this story different than those in other industries where you see similar trends at the corporate level. What makes this media broadcasting issue so important is that the airwaves are public resources. They're like national parks. We have allowed a small number of corporations to make a tremendous amount of money off of this public resource. And in exchange, they're required only to do the most meager kinds of public interest, public service. And in this case, they really fell down on the job. Unfortunately, the Minot story, which I really tell in great detail in the book, I found that the calls to 911 and got the exchanges there that really makes the story of media consolidation hit home in a way that I think it rarely does. I found similar stories about estranged and failed disaster coverage throughout the country. The dean of the communication school at University in Syracuse, David Rubin, complained during the August 2003 blackout that affected so much of the Northeast, that when he turned down the radio to find out what was going on, all the power went out. It was a scary moment. I was in New York City wondering what was going on. All he could get was news about New York City, that the local radio stations in his town just didn't have Syracuse news because they'd cleared out the newsroom. There weren't enough personnel to cover it.
Yeah. This is just anecdotal, Erica Kleinenberg, but we do a lot of state issues when we're on this talk show. We do a lot of state news coverage. We do some local coverage, but we are a statewide network. So, the city council meeting in Superior, Wisconsin doesn't usually get statewide coverage on a talk show, if you know what I mean, because
yep.
We have people from all over the state listening. But whenever we do a state issue, I swear most of the time we get less caller response to a state issue or a local issue than we do if we're talking about a national or international issue.
Mm.
Do people care that much about the local news?
Well, the evidence from the consumer studies that media companies do is that people care profoundly about what's happening in their hometowns, that they want local information. When there's a national or a state issue that you're covering, what people really want is to understand the context of those issues, and then they want to know how they're going to affect their lives, too. And so, in other words, if you live in a city that's got a chain newspaper, and you used to have a bureau set up in Washington, D.C., your bureau reporter used to be able to write about what was happening in Congress and then how the new bills or the changes in policy were going to affect your hometown. When you've got just one bureau reporter who's doing the reporting for 20, 30 newspapers, mm-hmm. you don't get that local connection. I want to be clear here. My argument is not that we should retreat into our hometowns and be parochial and forget about what's happening in the rest of the world. On the contrary, I think we've reached a point where we have a kind of media that saturates us with national and international news. Now, I'm not vouching for the quality of that news. I think there have been major problems with it. And one of the problems is just that many companies have pulled back on their bureaus and not put enough people out in the places where they need to be in order to cover stories well.
Mm-hmm.
That's clearly happened with a number of international bureaus. That's clearly happened at the national level. But the most dramatic cutbacks have been at the local level. And so in that balance of information that we need, that kind of big diet of news and cultural programming that makes us healthy members of this country, we have lost something fundamental, and it's that issue that I really hone in on in the book.
Let's go to Ken in Black River Falls. Good morning, Ken. You're on the air.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more with what this author is saying. There is a tremendous loss of just local voice. It just isn't. It's not there. Used to be in Madison, WIBA used to have this real wonderful local sound, and doesn't seem to have that anymore. It's happened all across the United States. Philadelphia used to have stations that had a real local flavor. Doesn't happen anymore. And the thing that probably should be done is people ought to go around and challenge licenses. That would be the answer in my mind as to how to address this thing. Because when you talk to people, and I have friends that are involved in media consolidation, as he's describing it, they say, well, you know, you got all these stations, you can cut back on the newsroom. Well, I've worked at radio stations, and newsrooms are kind of important and essential places in that station and in that community. And what happened in Minot, I'm sure you'll be told, well, it was just a freak event. It didn't happen too often. But I would say you have to be prepared, like the New York Times is, for the sinking of the Titanic every day. Yeah. And maybe there's a little less going on, but at least you're prepared.
Yeah. Challenge the license, Erica Kleinenberg? Is that the answer?
It's actually a strategy that communities are using throughout the country, from California to Maine. You find community organizations that are just fed up with the failure of their local outlets to cover their needs and to serve their most fundamental public interest obligations, and so they are challenging the licenses. Unfortunately, historically at the FCC, the license renewal has been a rubber stamping process, and we've yet to see the FCC really take seriously what it means, for example, to have a television broadcast company like the Sinclair Broadcast Group, which is profiled in the book that you might remember as a company that refused to, it owns more television stations than any company in the country, and in the run-up to the 2004 election, it refused to air the Nightline special where Ted Koppel read the names of American war casualties in Iraq. It also tried to broadcast a Stolen Honor documentary, which was the Swift Boat story about John Kerry. It tried to use its outlets as a political tool, and I know for a fact that there are two stations in Madison or Milwaukee. When you've got a company like this, it's clearly not serving the public interest. They also were trying to do this fake local news content, and so there are a number of organizations in the country that have tried to challenge Sinclair's broadcast renewal licenses. At a minimum, it produces a public debate about this issue, which is actually very difficult to get airtime for. The major media companies have almost no interest, or literally no interest, in covering this because they have so much at stake in it. So license challenges can be effective in that way. The bigger issue, though, is that the Federal Communications Commission, the FCC, has fallen into the grips of the industry that it's supposed to regulate. It is a captured agency. The media companies spend hundreds of millions of dollars over the last decade lobbying to get the kinds of laws that they want. In the run-up to the 2003 FCC ownership rulings, the media companies literally spent about $3 million sending FCC staffers and commissioners on junkets, on trips to places like Rio de Janeiro and Paris and Hong Kong and London, you know, not exactly hubs of American media policymaking. So when you have reports like that, you've got a clear sign that there's something wrong with a regulatory body that's meant to protect our people's interests. And I think we've had 10 years of terrible policymaking in this arena from Democrats and Republicans. But fortunately, and this is the second part of my book, the media reform movement that's emerged in the last few years is really beginning to reverse the tide, and congressional officials are beginning to recognize that they need to change things. In Wisconsin, Russ Feingold has clearly led the way on this. So there is a burgeoning movement, and I think some good things are coming.
Yeah, we'll talk about that movement a little bit more coming up after news from National Public Radio and Wisconsin Public Radio. We're talking with Eric Kleinenberg. He is author of the new book, Fighting for Air, The Battle to Control America's Media. Eric Kleinenberg, also an associate professor of sociology at New York University. The official launch of the book will be this weekend at the National Conference for Media Reform in Memphis, I believe. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Joy Cardine. It's about 7:36 right now on this Wednesday, January the 10th. We're talking about Fighting for Air, The Battle to Control America's Media. That's the name of the book by our guest this hour, Eric Kleinenberg, who is also an associate professor of sociology at New York University. 1-800-642-1234 is our toll-free telephone number if you'd like to join the conversation. In Madison, 263-1890, 263-1890, or send an email to talk@wpr.org. talk@wpr.org. Please include your first name and your community with your email. We're wondering whether it concerns you that big media conglomerates own so much of the media around the country and maybe right in your own town, and whether it concerns you that the radio stations that you listen to may just be carrying nationally syndicated programming only and not have any local reporters there or local people there, that your local TV station might be filling time with national features that have no local connection, that newspapers are carrying more and more syndicated material because of this media consolidation. How well served do you feel by the media in your town, and what can be done about this? Should something be done about this? 1-800-642-1234 in Madison, 263-1890. Our next caller who's been waiting is Dennis in Milwaukee. Hi, Dennis.
Hi, how you doing? Hey, listen, a couple of points. I worked in the media business, both on the electronic and print side, for 30 years. And what I've witnessed here is, I share the author's concerns about what's happened, but I have to tell you, frankly, these newspapers, TV stations, radio, they're all businesses, and they're businesses that reflect what people seem to want. And as someone who participates in the media, I got to tell you, it's been very disappointing to see people go away from local news. They would rather, apparently, based on most of the media samplings that are done by radio and TV and then newspapers, they would rather have feature stories. They'd rather have...
Yeah, and we're losing you on your cell phone, Dennis, but I think we get your point, Erica Kleinenberg. These various media outlets are businesses, and they're going to do what they need to do for newspaper sales and ratings and the like.
Oh, there's no question about that. They're very concerned about keeping those profit margins high. And actually, one big story to tell is that throughout the media industry, despite the talk of crisis you hear about newspapers, for example, the profit margins are extraordinarily high. Unfortunately, well, I don't agree with your caller that there's not an interest in local journalism. There's not an interest in local cultural programming. In fact, when you ask consumers what they want from media, they tell you this is precisely the kind of information they want. They want a better balance. Now, what we see is media companies that try to do this work on the cheap. So, for example, one popular thing that chain newspaper companies have done is replace local journalists with citizen voices and say, hey, let's do citizen journalism, and you can write in and tell us what you're thinking in a kind of folksy way. So you get first-person stories at the expense of hard-hitting journalism and beat coverage of City Hall or the school board. Those things cost a lot of money to produce. Actually, if you want evidence that there's a demand for local news, look at what's happened to your local television schedule over the last several years. Local TV stations are airing more local news programs than ever before. You can probably, you used to be able to just get one program in the morning, maybe one in the early evening and one at night. Now, television broadcast stations have television news, or, you know, local television news around the clock.
Yeah.
The problem is that they haven't invested in local staff to produce them. They're trying to do it on the cheap. So they recycle the same stories over and over and over again. They have the staff just totally overworked. If you go inside of a TV studio, you'll find reporters who just are racing to get story after story done. And that's the backstory behind these video news releases, the fake news and the propaganda that we saw so much of over the last couple of years. In other words, government agencies, the Bush administration has used them more than any previous administration, and also businesses. They pay to do fake news segments that they put out on satellite, and local news companies can pick them up and broadcast them. They can read scripts and perform them, really, as if they were actual local news stories. So the evidence is that they're trying to do local news. They're just trying to do it on the cheap. The question for me is, well, who's paying the price in the end? And my argument is this has had a tremendous cost to American citizens.
Yeah. Are you familiar with the Clear Channel station in Madison that is Air America-based programming that was going to be changed to a sports station?
I am. I know that story. Mm-hmm. And in fact, you know, Clear Channel is a fascinating company. It gets a lot of attention in the book. It's the first book to really profile the company at length. There are two chapters that are about the emergence of Clear Channel. One thing that can be said for it is that, or, you know, after the Minot story and after the complaints about its heavy-handed political coverage, the fleet of right-wing talk show hosts that it kept on the air, its rallies to support the war, its refusal to have outdoor advertisements that had anti-war sentiments in Times Square. They got so much bad publicity that the company tried to change its management in many respects. And one thing that they did is to become the largest broadcaster of Air America stations in the country. Now, to some extent, it's easier for them to do it because they own more than 1,200 stations, which they dwarf all the other radio companies. But they realized that they had gone too far, and they actually tried to reform a number of their practices. They knew they hadn't. They'd shut out local musicians and local culture, and they tried to do more of it. Unfortunately, they also realized this is a much more expensive proposition than they were interested in, and that's part of the backstory why a few weeks ago, Clear Channel sold for $26 billion.
Well, in fact, Gary in Menominee, I think, wanted to talk about that, so let me bring him on. Gary, go ahead.
Yeah, that was my question. I heard that they were just sold, and I listened to a station out of Minnesota. It's on 880 AM, and it's like Joe Chusseret's show.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
I was just curious, will that impact his show and, like, the local station here?
It very well might, and this is one of the things that a number of people complain about, both listeners and also people working in the media industry, that when companies change hands like this and the managers flip from one person to the next, you just have no idea what's going to happen to a show that's valuable for a town. Even a show that's really popular at the local level might get replaced, if the company actually owns, in addition to the station, a suite of syndicated programs that's cheaper for it to produce. They might want to decide, let's see how Rush Limbaugh plays in that market instead of the guy you've got there. And so there's this kind of arbitrariness about the process that can be very difficult for people to handle. What Clear Channel is planning to do now is to sell a bunch of stations in smaller markets. They want to sell several hundred stations and hold on to the stations they have that are in the 100 largest markets. And it's kind of anyone's guess what's going to happen to those stations when they're in new hands.
Yeah. The reason I was bringing up the Air America versus Fox Sports issue in Madison is that there's an example of citizens getting together, protesting, twisting arms, saying, let us have our Air America back, and apparently we're successful. Is that a victory as far as you're concerned?
Well, it's a small victory, but it's an important victory. And again, I take each of these local cases seriously, and I think we need more campaigns like this. I also think, and it's good that we're starting to move to this subject, that Americans today are working extraordinarily hard and across party lines to try to change the media. They're making campaigns like the one in Madison to say, actually, Madison, Wisconsin is a place where Air America would be really popular, and Fox might not be, even if it's a sports program. We want this kind of content. There is today a media reform movement, and I argue in the book that it's similar to the environmental movement of about 40 years ago, in that there are a number of people all over the country have said, we don't have to accept passively this kind of polluted system that we've been given. There's this kind of poison in the airwaves. Enough of it. Let's start to demand the media that we need and deserve. And they're organizing all sorts of exciting projects, from license renewal challenges to campaigns on specific companies to put valuable programming on the air, to large-scale demands for changes in ownership laws. Today, one of the big stories to hit the newspapers, and I write about this in Fighting for Air, is there's the first bill in the new Democratic Congress to try to protect network neutrality, freedom on the Internet, that would prevent the big telephone and cable companies that control the pipelines from giving us faster access to sites by deep-pocketed clients that pay them to reach us more quickly and put everyone else and all of their sites in the slow lane. This is tremendously important legislation. And when the telecom industry threatened to change the structure of the Internet, basically to make it more like cable TV and less like the net we know now, a million Americans, again, across party lines, signed up in the Save the Internet coalition and did tremendous work. So they're inspiring stories like this, and I think we have to learn from the local successes.
Yeah. We are talking with Eric Kleinenberg, author of Fighting for Air, The Battle to Control America's Media. Says that most of our media controlled by just a few corporations, and that truly local journalism and local community service is at risk. 1-800-642-1234 and Madison 263-1890. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network. This is the Ideas Network. I'm Joy Cardine, about 12 minutes before 8 o'clock right now. Reminder that we will be carrying President Bush's address to the nation tonight when he unveils his new strategy for the war in Iraq. And all morning long, tomorrow morning between 6 and 9, I will talk with guests from different perspectives to react and analyze what the president had to say. That's coming up tomorrow morning, tonight and tomorrow morning here on the Ideas Network. We're talking with Eric Kleinenberg for the rest of this hour. He is the author of the new book, Fighting for Air, The Battle to Control America's Media. And our next caller is Shay in Madison. Hi, Shay, you're on the air.
Hi, good morning.
Morning.
The comment that I wanted to make sort of follows up on the previous caller. I think his name was Dennis, and he was talking about, you know, media being a business. And I was at the Media Reform Conference in Madison, and one of the points that was made that really inspired me was the idea that the airwaves are a public resource and that the media companies use them and don't pay royalties, as I understand, to the public in any way for the use of these airwaves. And in exchange for that, they're...
In exchange for that, Shay, we lost you. I'm not sure why that happened.
Well, we could probably finish her sentence, which
sure.
is they have some modest public interest obligations that they pledge that they will serve the public with a number of programs and with basic service like information when there's an emergency. So it's a business that's a little bit different than, say, the chain retail business, right? We know the story of Walmart. We know the story of Starbucks replacing the local coffee shop. We know the story of the chain booksellers replacing our local bookstores. The media story I'm telling in Fighting for Air is similar, but it rests on this fundamental difference that the broadcast industry is predicated on use of the public airwaves. So it's not simply a business. And in fact, I write in the book about a decade of radical deregulation, you know, so far out of touch with the American people that even the most strict economic libertarians, people like William Safire, are upset about the scale of what's happened with our consolidated media system. This is a business, the broadcast industry, that demands regulation from government. If you own radio stations, if you're Clear Channel, you need the government to regulate the airwaves. Otherwise, someone else can set up a radio tower and broadcast right over your signal. So it's a special kind of business, and clearly we need to get some teeth back into our regulation.
Yeah. Do you want to see something like the Fairness Doctrine put into place again?
Well, the Fairness Doctrine could be really important. It would clearly change the way that AM talk radio works and a lot of news programming on television works. But I'm really concerned about the ownership cap issue. I think that's where the heart of this matter is, for example. I mean, until 1996, for example, there was far more competition in local radio markets. 50 years ago, most major American cities had several newspapers. Today, more than 90% of American cities have only one newspaper. Television networks are now allowed to reach 39% of the nation's audience with their own affiliate stations and network-owned and operated affiliates. And that's radically changed the relationship between local stations and the networks. It used to be that networks would pay local stations to air their programming. Now they actually often demand reverse compensation. You've got to pay if you want to broadcast something from one of the networks in many towns. This system just is not working, and I think it's time to revisit our laws on ownership, and thankfully the FCC does too, and I think it's important for everyone to know that this year, 2007, the FCC is returning to the media ownership laws, and it's going to issue sweeping regulatory decisions on a range of issues that could really change the future of our media. Despite the fact that that Congress is democratically controlled right now, the FCC remains 3-2 Republican majority. Kevin Martin, the new chairman, is a little bit less radical than Michael Powell, who ran the agency during Bush's first term. But he seems to have the same intent fundamentally, which is to continue this deregulatory sweep. So this is an urgent moment for Americans to speak out. We've been very successful on network neutrality, and now I think we need to turn our attention to the ownership issue too.
Judy in Milwaukee is with us next. Hi, Judy.
Yes, I am not a native Milwaukee person, but I have lived here for a number of years. And because the only AM radio stations are right-wing radio or sports radio, and I don't have any interest in that, I don't know anything about local business. I listen to the Chicago station and hope it's giving me the right weather. And so I do my shopping in New York or Chicago because I don't know anything about local business. Isn't it bad for local business to only have right-wing radio and sports radio?
Yeah, and isn't it bad for the radio companies themselves? And I think this is the problem with the argument, you know, that consumers are only interested in a certain kind of news, or that, you know, the companies give us what we demand. I mean, clearly, in a state like Wisconsin, it's a swing state. It's split politically. It's got some very liberal clusters. It's got some conservative clusters. The interests of the people in Wisconsin are not reflected on AM radio. If AM radio is replete with fairly extreme conservative talk, and if you live in Milwaukee and can't find a different perspective, there's something wrong with the market, right? The theory should be that the companies are serving demand, but we know that that's not happening. That's why I think this story about what happened in Madison is so important. Unfortunately, you know, and I go to great length to tell these stories in the book. There are companies like Clear Channel, like the Sinclair Broadcast Group, like the Tribune Company based in Chicago, that are politically so far out of touch with their audiences that they're doing programming that's one-sided and that's bad for the democratic process.
Robin in Sandstone is with us now. Hi, Robin.
Hi, good show. Thanks for taking my call. What concerns me is I really think that big media, big TV in particular, they really don't care to change what they're doing. You know, even when we get a whiff of some of the, you know, the smut or perversion or whatever they're going to throw on the air, and a million people or 2 million people, whatever, email or phone call them, and they drop that show because of the reaction to what's coming. But you know what? A week or two or a month later, that same smut or perversion or immorality is right back on the air again. And it's like we have to continually beat these big conglomerates to let them know we don't want this junk on the air. And that's my concern. Thank you.
Yeah, well, there have been a number of studies that show that the most junky programming, the stuff that really offends people, that seems to be so out of line with mainstream taste, comes from the big media corporations, including ones that really cultivate relationships with the religious conservatives, with the Christian right, that you would think would be quite concerned about the issues about decency and indecency in programming. But what happens, actually, when you've got a kind of chain media system, is that you get media companies that are really out of touch with the communities that they serve. So if you own a radio station in Madison or a newspaper in Milwaukee, and you're there and you're part of the community, it's much easier to be invested in it and to have a good sense of what people want, what people are interested in, what the boundaries are for programming.
Yeah.
If you're based in San Antonio, Texas, or New York or Los Angeles, it's much more difficult to get a sense for that. And so a lot of people who are part of the Campaign for Media Reform are demanding more local control. And there are clearly a lot of people who are thinking about newspapers today who think, you know, maybe it's not a good idea to have companies like Gannett that own 100 daily papers throughout the country. Maybe what we need are more locally owned and operated newspapers.
Yeah, let me get in Cliff in Watertown. We're almost out of time, but it says here that Cliff was working in Minot for Clear Channel at that time, Cliff?
Oh, I know about the Clear Channel incident, and any radio station overnight is working with a group of people, usually part-timers, who wouldn't be able to handle a major news thing. The emergency alert system should be used for that. And I think Clear Channel has solved that problem in that market. Here in Wisconsin, the emergency alert system is better set up as we see the Amber Alerts and we see things.
Yeah, we have that, but the, So anyway, what about emergency alert system? That would solve it, Eric Kleinenberg.
Oh, well, I mean, this is told in the story of mm-hmm. Minot, and
we're almost out of time.
Basically, the office tried to use the emergency alert system. It failed. There's a dispute over on what end it failed. But then they just called the radio station, and all the stations were on autoplay. The bigger problem was that there was no one there answering the phone who could go on the air and issue alert, or even call someone who could get to the station and mm-hmm. do that. So it was hours before anyone was there. These were stations that were empty. They were empty studios. Mm-hmm. They weren't serving people.
Well, we really appreciate your time. Thanks very much. You'll be launching the book this weekend, and then you're back in Chicago next week for a book sale.
I'm back home to Chicago next mm-hmm. week to do a couple of talks and going to about 11 or 12 cities.
Yeah. Thanks a lot for being with us.
Pleasure.
Eric Kleinenberg is author of the book Fighting for Air, The Battle to Control America's Media, also an associate professor of sociology at New York University. His first book you might be familiar with, Heat Wave, A Social Autopsy of Disaster in Chicago. Thanks to Karen Prager for producing this hour. I'm Joy Cardine. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.